is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
These reports are coming in again and again. 25,000 human rights violations for this year, including extortion, including looting, certainly sexual violence.
That was Human Rights Agency spokesman Boris Chestrikov on how the viciousness and magnitude of recent attacks in the Eastern DRC have reached a level not seen before. Details coming up. Also, Tunisia's President Kais Saied says he is ready to change the country's constitution. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The UN envoy to Libya, Jan Kubis, warns fresh conflict could break out if elections are not held on December 24th as planned. He told the UN Security Council that many Libyans would see aborting the drive for elections as a signal that violence is the only path to power. He noted that the Libyan House of Representatives is finalizing the electoral law for parliamentary voting without consulting the High Council of State. Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the threats facing the Libyan elections with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
The government of national unity was confirmed by the House of Representatives as intended by the Libya Political Dialogue Forum and charged with leading the country just up to the elections on 24 December 21. And this was also endorsed by the United Nations and the Security Council Resolution 2571. Therefore, the legitimacy of the GNU after December 24 will be at least questionable. According to the LPDF, the UN and Libya's parliament, the main purpose of Abdulhamid Dabeiba's government of national unity is just to prepare for elections. An increasing number of Libyans blame Dabeiba that he acts only half-hearted on this, while selling out the country to Turkey and neglecting the East and the South. So if the elections don't take place on December 24, and if there is not even a firm and agreed date for elections at this time, many could lose confidence in the political path and into the unity of Libya. So unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we'll see, Libya is closing again to a turning point to the better or to the worse.
Mr. Kubis said the House of Representatives adopted the presidential electoral law, and he was told it is in the process of finalizing the electoral law for parliamentary elections. However, High Council of State in Libya complained that the presidential electoral law was adopted without consulting any of its members. U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the UN, Jeffrey De Laurentiis, said the parties need to agree on a constitutional and legal framework for elections urgently. Is that feasible?
Well, it can certainly be debated if the preparation of this electoral law for presidential elections was in line with the Libya political agreement. According to this LPA, consultations between the High Council of State and the House of Representatives are required, but the decision remains with the House of Representatives. So the question is, what are consultations? After Tunisia's president suspended the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated parliament in Tunis, and after the Muslim Brotherhood in Morocco earned a devastating defeat in the recent election, in Libya, the Muslim Brotherhood and the other Islamists are increasingly nervous about the prospect of having elections in December. Therefore, it is not likely, I would almost rule it out, that the High Council of State will agree to this law. But maybe it is possible that they could just somehow live with it without undermining the credibility of the elections. I would say the fear of a defeat should not be a reason to undermine a democratic process. The United Nations, the United States, and other key Western states are increasingly clear in accepting this somehow controversial election law for presidential election as a basis for the December elections. Strictly speaking, if one wants to have elections on December 24, there is no other realistic option than to go with this law.
Khalifa Haftar, commander of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, has hired former U.S. politician Lanny Davis, the special counsel to former U.S. President Bill Clinton, and former Republican House lawmaker Robert Livingston to lobby for him in the United States and arrange Haftar's meetings with officials from across the U.S. political scene, including from the White House, Pentagon, State Department, and Congress. What do you make of all that?
Hefter, who is also a US citizen, does not have a very positive image in the United States for various reasons, also for some good reasons. There was even a lawsuit filed against him by some Libyan Americans. But until recently, Hefter did not really care very much about all this. Now he has realized that the United States, especially Special Envoy Richard Norland and Acting Assistant Secretary of State Joy Hood, are increasingly diplomatically active over Libya. And this matters for him, especially in a time when Libya is probably heading towards a new turning point with the elections or the postponement of the elections in December. And as Hefter himself considers to pursue a political career, maybe even running for presidency, he obviously intends to improve his image in Washington and to get in touch with some officials, preferably influential officials, to explain them his point about the future of Libya.
That was Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. The UN Refugee Agency is calling for more effective measures to protect millions of civilians in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo subjected to killings, kidnappings, and savage abuse by armed groups. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Dozens of armed groups have been committing violence against civilians in eastern DRC for more than two decades. But the UN Refugee Agency says the viciousness and magnitude of the attacks have reached a level not seen before. The UNHCR and its partners have recorded more than 1,200 civilian deaths and 1,100 rapes in 2021 in the two most affected provinces of North Kivu and Ituri. The agency says ferocious attacks have driven more than 1 million Congolese in the east of the country from their homes this year alone. UNHCR spokesman Boris Cheshyakov says most assaults have been perpetrated by the Allied Democratic Forces, a rebel group with Ugandan roots operating in eastern DRC. He says the group's attacks have been increasing in brutality and frequency since late 2020.
These reports are coming in again and again. 25,000 human rights violations for this year, including extortion, including looting, certainly sexual violence, horrific reports that our staff and our partners are receiving, and the extreme violence against civilians. So our call is very clear. This is a call that we are constantly making. We need more measures to protect civilians.
Violence and abuse have displaced more than 5 million people inside the DRC, the second highest number of internally displaced after Syria. Cheshyakov says repeated displacement is putting enormous financial pressure on impoverished host communities and risking wearing out those communities' welcome mat.
Harsh living conditions and a lack of food often trigger premature return by displaced people to their place of origin, further exposing them to abuse and violence. In fact, returnees account for 65% of the serious human rights abuses that we and our partners have recorded.
Cheshyakov notes the life-saving needs of this ever-growing displaced population are increasing, but his agency, he says, can only respond to a fraction of them because it is out of money. With less than 4 months left in 2021, he says the UNHCR has received only 51% of the $205 million required to carry out humanitarian operations in the DRC this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Tunisian President Kais Saied has announced plans to form a new government and vowed that he would only use existing constitutional means. Addressing the nation on television, Saied said he respected the 2014 democratic constitution, but that it was not eternal and could be amended. The moderate Islamist Ennahda party, the biggest in parliament with a quarter of the seats according to Reuters, has accused Saied of carrying out a coup and said deviating from the constitution would mean a retreat from democracy. The main labor union in Tunisia also has signaled it opposes the idea of suspending the constitution. Saied sacked his prime minister and suspended parliament July 25th. South Africans are breathing a sigh of relief after President Cyril Ramaphosa lowered the country's COVID-19 lockdown measures to level 2, one step before restrictions are completely removed. Businesses say this is time for them to recover. But with daily infection figures still around 4,000, some experts are warning that relaxing could trigger a fourth wave. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Starting today, up to 250 South Africans are allowed to gather indoors and a maximum of 500 outside. The curfew has been shortened by an hour to 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. Alcohol sales for off-site consumption are now permitted 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Friday, while drinkers can be in the bars till 10 p.m. However, in his national address yesterday, President Cyril Ramaphosa expressed concerns on the low numbers of South Africans getting vaccinated. He said the government is considering introducing vaccination passports to reduce access to public places by those who aren't inoculated.
If many people are not vaccinated and remain vulnerable to infection, the chance of new and more dangerous variants emerging is far greater. This is why vaccines are currently the most potent weapon we have to fight this pandemic.
The relaxation of the restrictions has been broadly welcomed by South Africans. Many have lost their jobs due to limited business activity and are hoping they'll be able to return to work. Mto Kulu from the South African Chamber of Commerce spoke to reporters.
Tourism, hospitality, eventing, those are the ones that were hardest hit and those are the ones that are going to benefit the most. Even industry also benefits from lowering of levels because confidence rises. So commerce and industry are intertwined and activity improves once the levels go down because confidence is restored and people can plan longer and more freer and have to make more commitments to the economy.
Churches are happy too, although Bishop Mbumlwana, Secretary General of the South African Council of Churches, told a local television station that they were looking to gather in groups even higher than 500.
The religious leaders had actually requested for not the number, but a percentage, something like 50% of the space, so that if you've got a 6,000 seater, you can have 2,000 people, 2,500 people, or even 1,000 people. There will be plenty of space for distancing and all that is required for COVID protocols.
But health expert Angelique Kutsie cautions against large gatherings.
Our infection rate is still too high. It's 11%. We can only start to grieve much later once if it is 5% or less. Seeing that we are going to move into elections, that might be a problem going forward during the elections, but only time will tell us.
The coronavirus has infected over 2.8 million South Africans with more than 84,000 COVID-19-related deaths. 14.6 million citizens have been vaccinated so far, although some of those are still waiting for their second jab. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A study by South Africa's Medical Research Council, the MRC, reveals that the country's COVID-19 death toll is much higher than official statistics show. The nation is the African country's worst hit by the pandemic. The government says COVID-19 has claimed the lives of almost 85,000 people since March last year. But as Darren Taylor reports, the MRC's research shows the true scale of the pandemic in South Africa.
The MRC has been tracking the number of deaths registered with the state since the pandemic began. Lead scientist Debbie Bradshaw and her team analyzed all natural deaths recorded in this period each week. They compared the numbers with the average recorded in previous years when COVID-19 wasn't a factor.
And we've seen these very sharp increases in the numbers of deaths as the waves of the COVID pandemic have unfolded. And when we add up the excess deaths that we're seeing, it's more or less three times higher than the numbers that are reported as the confirmed COVID deaths.
So, says the study, coronavirus has killed almost 255,000 people in South Africa so far. Bradshaw's confident that the spikes in fatalities studied by her team are as a result of COVID-19.
They've been absolutely tightly correlated with the numbers of COVID cases and COVID deaths. It just leaves no room for mistaking it for anything else. It's correlated on a spatial level and a temporal level.
She doesn't believe there's any malice in the government's underreporting of deaths from COVID-19.
The challenge that we have got is that there are people who are succumbing very quickly and may die before they get to a health system or may have chosen not to go to the health service. And they're just not getting into the statistical system that the Department of Health runs.
Only 7 million of a targeted 40 million people have been fully vaccinated in South Africa, and a fourth wave of the pandemic is expected to hit in December. Bradshaw's hoping that her study will make citizens realize that COVID-19 is still a big danger.
There's some sort of complacency about COVID, and perhaps although many people have got family members who've been affected, there just isn't the sense of urgency around vaccination that there should be, where it's absolutely clear that the people who are getting seriously ill are the unvaccinated people. And I would really like to urge anybody and everybody to make sure they get their vaccination.
Bradshaw's call comes as President Cyril Ramaphosa eases restrictions designed to prevent rapid spread of COVID-19. Whenever this has happened in the past, infection rates and deaths have increased in the months that followed the relaxation of regulations, such as limits on numbers of people at public gatherings. If vaccination rates remain as low as they currently are leading into the fourth wave, Bradshaw warns that South Africa's COVID-19 death toll will be even more horrific than the numbers released by her team at the MRC. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Abu Zarba al-Zuwai, a photographer arrested and jailed in Libya 3 years ago, has been freed. The French news agency AFP reported that a military tribunal sentenced Zawai to 15 years in May 2020 for communicating with a television channel that supported terrorism. The conviction sparked dismay from the UN support mission in Libya. It said Zawai's detention and trial appeared to violate Libya's laws as well as international obligations on the rights to a fair trial and freedom of expression. A statement from the military prosecutor's office in the city of Benghazi says Zawai was released after benefiting from a special amnesty from the general command of the armed forces under Khalifa Haftar's control. Malawi's High Court has found a businessman guilty of attempting to bribe constitutional court judges who were ruling on the disputed 2019 presidential election. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Thomson Mpinganjira, who owns a commercial bank in Malawi, was arrested in January of last year by the Anti-Corruption Bureau, or ACB, after the High Court's Chief Justice, Andrew Nyirenda, reported he had attempted to bribe the judges. Mpinganjira was accused of offering judges an unspecified amount of money so that a court case over the disputed 2019 presidential election would end in favor of then-President Peter Mutharika. Mpinganjira had pleaded not guilty to 6 bribery-related charges, but in her judgment Friday, High Court Judge Dorothy De Gabriel said the court proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Mpinganjira wanted to bribe the 5 judges.
The court finds the accused person guilty under count 1 and 2 for offering an advantage to Justice Potani and Justice Dembo, who were public officers, and for the benefit of that advantage to be shared amongst the judges to induce the judges to make a decision in favor of the respondent. The accused person is hereby convicted accordingly.
Mpinganjira's lawyer, Tamando Chokoto, asked the court to consider giving his client non-custodial punishment, saying his client is a first offender and that he is a responsible man.
And you may recall, my lady, as well, the fact that at some point we had to adjourn the hearing of the matter when your defendant had suffered from COVID. Ever since that time, his health has been compromised and he has been in frequent need of medical attention.
Reinek Matemba is Malawi's Solicitor General. He dismissed calls for the non-custodial sentence, saying the convict needs a maximum prison sentence to serve as a lesson to potential offenders.
What the convict wanted to do, the offense which he had committed, the very serious offense, he wanted to defeat the course of justice in one of the most high profile, if not the most high profile case in this country ever.
Following the conviction, Judge De Gabriel revoked Mpinganjira's bail and remanded him to Jichili Prison in Blanta, where he will wait for his sentencing. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta, Malawi.
Gunmen killed 9 naval personnel, a soldier, and 2 police officers after they attacked and torched a military base in Nigeria's northwest Zamfara state and escaped with weapons. According to the French news agency AFP, it was not immediately clear who carried out the Saturday raid, although the army is engaged in operations in Zamfara against armed criminal gangs who are blamed for a series of mass abductions and have become increasingly brazen. The base is a key site for logistics and reconnaissance in the army's fight against bandits in the area. In July, gunmen shot down an Air Force jet over Zamfara while it was returning from operations. The pilot safely ejected. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.